Welcome, welcome, welcome back to Nuclear Medicine Men Podcast. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you very much for listening. I appreciate all the support. Rate the show. Review the show. I got 5 stars. 5-star ratings on Apple Podcasts, which I'm very thankful for, which I'm surprised about in a certain way, because my audio is a little bit trash. Especially when it comes to Skype, but there is a method behind that, which you're probably thinking, why? And the reason is that I didn't want to go out and buy a load of expensive equipment before I knew that I was really going to be committed to it. But now I know that I am, I'm definitely going to go out and get the elusive SM7B. You know, the famous Joe Rogan microphone, pretty much. But yeah, thank you guys. Go and check us out everywhere on TikTok, on Instagram. Got rid of Twitter because it's why. Because it's terrible. The guest today is Paul Stobbs, and he has a very, very interesting take on the Nephilim. We hear this word bounced around so many times, I sort of lost its gravitas at this point. But he sort of reels it back in, and the correlations, you know, that he's made, that he's seen, that he's exposed, is insane about how much they do actually look like clowns. And we get into how clowns in this day and age came to be. And hint, hint, wink, wink, teaser, it was a Freemason that did it. Now, nothing against the Freemasons, you know, you do what you want. But, yeah, it's very strange, I'd say, that this motif is still existing. Because it's sort of, you know, it's arbitrary and it's ubiquitous throughout Western culture. The clown, you know, it's the clown. You go to a circus, you see a clown. You know, I personally don't like clowns. I'm not scared of them. Because I know some people are like scared of clowns. I just don't like them. So I dislike clowns in the same way that I dislike drag. Drag, to me, it's just weird. I just don't like it. It's not because I have some sort of like repressed homosexual clown energy that I'm keeping down under. Nothing to do with that. I just don't like it. I just find it weird. But so today's guest, Paul Stobbs, fantastic interview, really, really good. He knows his stuff and he can just go and go and go, which is what I like, because I'm not the type of guy that would just, you know, stop interviews, you know, and just to talk and stuff like that. Like, obviously I will if there's questions that I need to ask, but when someone's got so much work they need to unpack, I just let them do it. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but, you know, I'm sure you'll let me know. So, comment as well. Comment, rate, review, like, subscribe, or whatever. Do what you got to do. I don't really give a shit either way, to be honest. But, yeah, just do what you got to do. And, enjoy this episode of Nuclear Medicine Men. Back on your podcast platform, whatever. I fucked that up. Another thing as well, actually, I thought, is, so normally at the end of the episode, I put the intro song, I put the full song at the end of the podcast, just for your listening pleasure, but what I thought was I'll mix it up a little bit, and the song at the end of the episode today, I'm telling you now, if you've got a mind like mine, you're gonna fucking love it. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. It's so funny. It's like a comedy song, but I guarantee you will laugh. I guarantee it. It's so funny. It's by a guy called Tom Cardy. I'm going to start putting a couple of his songs at the end of episodes just because they're so funny. I really enjoy them. So check the episode out. See if you like it. If you do, you know what to do. Rate, review, share, fucking like, all that bollocks. Right, goodbye. I will leave you to this conversation with Paul Stobbs. Right, goodbye. Bye, 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 bye. Spectacular terrorist event. Nuclear medicine man. Smack your guard with a...
is. Whether you bang on the block or pour a room for billions.
Right, so we got Paul Stobbs on the line today. Hello, Paul, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, no worries at all. Now, today we're exploring something that, like I just said to you before we started recording, was something that sort of like caught my eye. And I was thinking, is it a bit of like a, not a gimmick, but just sort of like a theory for theory's sake? And wow, like I just said to you, wow, it is the amount of evidence that you have gathered. There is no debate. So let's walk into a little bit of how you sort of, obviously I don't want, you know, the sort of like the bio to dominate the show too much, you know,
but yeah.
Just a little brief overview of what you do, where people can find you, and how it got started for you, please.
Sure. Yeah. I think people who've been following my work for a while now are probably sick of hearing my origin story, to be honest.
That's why I didn't really.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
For posterity's sake, I'll try and sum it up in like 5 to 10 minutes, just so we can get on to the good stuff. But so I run a YouTube channel called Understanding Conspiracy. I've had it for about a decade now. It was originally a university project I created in 2014, but I've been researching since 2011, really. I came out of the New Age psychedelic Gnostic perspective. I was a psychedelic consciousness explorer type of individual, typical, stereotypical art student. You know what I mean? Smoking weed every day, taking as many drugs as I possibly could just to try and explore these other realms and speak to entities and all that type of thing, you know? And I ended up delving into conspiracy research because the end of the world was coming round in 2012. With the end of the Mayan calendar, and that sparked my interest to wonder, well, what the hell are these people seeing that's making them think this? You know, what is going on?
Yeah.
And that basically, it was my inception into conspiracy, you know, and that started going from rabbit hole to rabbit hole and discovering everything from the initial corruption all the way down to the deep occulted corruption, you know what I mean? You just go deeper and deeper and deeper and end up peeling back all the layers. And you know, long story short, I was saved in 2014. So after a few years of being in that realm, I ended up finding that the truth was basically in the Christian perspective. That's where I found the truth to be in the end. And it pulled me out of that life, you know, and of that drug-addled life in a way. It did literally save my life. And I'm now 8 years sober. I don't touch anything like that anymore. I barely even drink, only on special occasions. And even then I don't go hard because I just can't anymore. It doesn't work for me. I just get sick, to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't enjoy it anymore. I suppose in that sense, I was born again. You know, that old person died and I'm now a new individual from that process. So, the whole conspiracy world, the truth and movement, all that research really did save me, you know, and pulled me out of a life of misery, pain, emptiness, hollow spirituality, and literal death from the heavy amounts of drugs I was doing. So that's my turn to Christian angles very quickly summed up. I've explained it in that testimony has been said in much longer detail in many other places, and I'm sure people can go and find that you know, from older podcasts if they want to know more about that. But essentially what got me onto the Nephilim and the clown situation is because I was heavily seeped in basically occult knowledge prior to the conspiracy stuff. And because I'd kind of come out of that into the Christian worldview, I was doing a lot of biblical history research into things like the pre-flood world and the Nephilim and demons and what they are and their origins, basically. I was inspired heavily by Gary Wayne's work. He's a huge researcher in this field.
Yeah.
And it kind of answered a lot of questions for me during that time when I was an early Christian, you know, trying to find answers to these hard questions like, why did God send a flood? How could God kill all these innocent people in Canaan, all these typical things that put people off, you know, of wanting to follow a god like that, and discovering that there was actually some pretty nasty corruption going on at the time, which kind of justified these actions from a particular race of creatures that never should have existed, basically, that we call the Nephilim. And I believe you've just had Vicky Joy Anderson on, haven't you?
Yeah.
And I'm sure she's gone deep into the Nephilim in that show just recently.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I just talked to her yesterday on my channel. Okay. Funnily enough, it's a small world. We all were walking very small circles in this culture. But yeah, so the Nephilim is probably something you're very well aware of. And I think people who have been in the conspiracy world for long enough inevitably get onto this subject. And yeah. That's what happened to me. And I wouldn't say I became an expert on it, but I knew a lot about biblical history by the 2016 period. And I also knew a lot about the conspiracy culture, the people who, the secret societies, how they operate, how the occult works, how the spirit realm works. I kind of had a wealth of knowledge in many subjects, kind of a jack of all trades situation, a scattershot conspiracy theorist. And that's what my channel was all about. You know, it was about just talking about every single topic I could imagine, but also kind of analyzing the truth of movement itself as a thing, and truthers as people, and the experiences they kind of have and waking up always fascinated me. So I made a lot of videos kind of helping people deal with waking up, you know, because it's a shocking experience and a lot of people don't handle it very well and end up isolating themselves, losing friends and all sorts of things. So my work was very much centered around that for a short period of time. And suddenly in 2016, there was this clown sighting thing happening where people were dressed in creepy outfits like clowns on street corners, just looking menacing. And the media was plastering it everywhere. It was on every social media avenue. And it's like they wanted us to see that these people are dressing like clowns all over the place. And by this point, you know, I knew very well that the media does not put anything in front of us through the mainstream avenues unless they want us to see it. It's all a symbol to them. Everything is symbology to them. It's a language for the initiated. And if this clown is being shown everywhere, there's something symbolic about it that needs to be kind of deciphered. There's a reason they're doing that. And I had a few spiritual experiences in the lead up to this, the years leading up to this, where I knew about the DMT jesters because I came out of that world, and it's a huge talking point, you know, and it's something I was already very well aware of. I had my own vision years after quitting psychedelics, where I was kind of sent back to the DMT realm, and I had a vision of a giant jester, and I was in the fractal matrix, the astral realm, whatever you want to call it, that place you go when you break through on DMT. And for 10 seconds, I just looked up at this giant. I was in front of his feet, you know what I mean? And he was enormous. And it was this black and white striped humanoid type thing with very long limbed features and pointy features everywhere. And it had a big wide purple smile grin and huge golden glowing eyes. And its head was shaped like a jester's hat. But it wasn't wearing clothes. It didn't have a jester's hat on. Its skull was shaped like that. It was very weird. And just as quickly as I saw this thing, I snapped back to reality again. You know, and I put that down to what trippers call a flashback. You have these moments where you just end up tripping again and you have no control over it. And then it's one of these. If people have done it a lot, suffer from this phenomena where they just trip. And they haven't done anything. They just suddenly start tripping and the brain just switches quickly. And I think that's, I put it down to that at the time, but now I'm wondering if it was a very controlled experience kind of given to me by God to show me something. Because it's one of those other things that ended up in the back of my mind that I kind of never forgot, you know. And then I had another nightmare where I was being chased by an entity called the Hat Man, which is an extremely popular creature within you know, demonology. A lot of people say they encounter this creepy hat man figure wearing a trench coat in physical waking life and in dreams. And like at bedtime in sleep paralysis, it's often associated with the shadow people, you know. And I had my own encounter in a vivid dream where I saw this weird looking creature and these multicolored ribbons flying off him in all directions with this fedora hat and this golden glowing eyes and this big long purple trench coat. And it was just a terrifying experience, a truly terrifying experience. And funnily enough, I was talking to Vicky Joy Anderson about this yesterday because we did a talk about how the spirit realm works. And she was telling me how demons kind of use covenants, just like they do in biblical times, about with like a marriage, let's say. There's three parts to a covenant when it gets made, and the three parts are the contract, and then there's the consummation, and then at the end it's kind of the marriage. That's it. That's the official. It's the celebration at the end. So there's three parts. There's the contract, the consummation, and the celebration to a Jewish Hebrew wedding. And that's how all contracts and covenants are made. And they say that demons do the same things to us in our dreams. But a consummation. So first of all, a deal is made. You know, you a demon will come to you, perhaps in a dream, and make a deal with you. You know, I'll make you famous as long as you allow X, Y, Z, you know, you forward our agenda. And you might not remember you made the deal because it was in a dream that you forgot, but it doesn't matter. A deal can still be made. And then she said, you know, a consummation has to happen next. And that can be either you'll have a sex dream, which is obviously what happens in marriage. You consummate the marriage by having sex, or it can be sharing and eating food. And this happened to me in my dream. I was walking through a park and I came across dead relatives in a park eating food, having a bit of a party with a banquet. And I ate and drank the tea that they offered me. And as soon as I ate the food, I got a phone call in the dream telling me, it was a voice saying, "I've not forgot about the conversation we had. I'm coming for you now." And I remembered a dream I had months ago where I made a deal with something. And I can't remember what the deal was or anything, but I remember I met this character who's calling me right now in a dream months ago, like almost a year ago, you know. And then I realized it was at a party where I consummated the deal I had made in this previous dream. And as soon as I consummated it by drinking the tea and eating the food, the hat man appeared to kind of finalize the deal. Do you get what I mean? Please. I know. I only just figured this out yesterday talking with Vicky Joy Anderson about this experience I had years ago. It's been on my channel for like 7 years, this video where I explain the experience with visuals and drawings and stuff, like a story. And I've just figured out that this hat man entity is some kind of deep, weird accountant of the underworld of some kind, you know, like a lawyer maybe, who comes to collect when the time is necessary. And either way, that being said, as like a side note, I had these spiritual experiences that were all pointing towards something to do with circus related, jester related imagery in the spirit realm. And then the clown thing happened in 2016 and my mind was just reeling by this point. So I just on a whim kind of was drawn to basically say into Google or YouTube search clowns and Nephilim. Is there anything connecting these two things together? Because I understood that demons were the disembodied spirits of Nephilim. These DMT jesters must be the spirits, you know. There's something here, isn't there, is what I just kind of, made the connection. And I found a video of one person who was making a joke video about conspiracy theorists, kind of taking the piss out of us. And it was done in that History Channel style, you know, the overly dramatic explanations for situations, you know, with dramatic, silly imagery in the background. And he was describing the Nephilim as pale-skinned, white-haired creatures and all sorts of other things, you know. And he basically said the only logical conclusion is that they're interdimensional killer clowns, you know. And he was making a joke. He was taking the piss out of the concept of the Nephilim. He wasn't being serious. He's not a conspiracy theorist. And I heard him say it, and I was like, there's something to this. You know, it kind of clicked in my mind, like, this isn't a joke. And I just started rolling with it. And 7 years later, here I am with a 40-part episode series, hours of research. I'm halfway through writing a 30-chapter book on the thing, and I'm doing the podcast circuit explaining it. And the connections have just, they've just come flying at me, you know, and I've inadvertently become the world's leading expert on clowns in relations to Nephilim. And it's not like I intended this to be my life, you know, but that's where I ended up. And I know what it sounds like, you know, I know what the Nephilim look like, clowns. And when someone hears that, like you said, your initial reaction is, this is going to be some kind of joke, right? This is going to be something weird, isn't it? Funny, this is just a strange idea. But then, you know, I don't see it as a laughing matter personally. I take it very seriously, and I think when people will see my research, they'll realize it's actually a very serious anthropological study of cultures all around the earth and their veneration of the Nephilim through their rituals. And you'll find that they often dress or create artwork or masks in a style that venerates and mimics the spirits that they're trying to be possessed by. And those spirits that they dress like or make artwork or statues dedicated to have clownish features. So there's variations all over the place, but the archetypical aesthetics are the same throughout. There's a weaving pattern, you know. And I found, basically, in conclusion to my research, is that all of these imageries of these ancestors' spirits, which are the Nephilim, have been amalgamated together in the West to create a caricatured image that we call a clown. And I've also figured out it's been done intentionally by secret societies to create something that the public wouldn't understand and would think is silly and for children, so would never question it. So it's an occult symbol, it's a hidden symbol, but the hidden meaning for that symbol is that it's a representation of the Nephilim spirits. And it gives the secret societies an ability, a way, let's say, of dressing like demons in their public invocation rituals within lodges and within circuses in the public to bring forth the spirits into our realm in the West without people realizing that that's what's happening. It's a sneaky, clever way for Shriners, for example, who all have their own clown sect, to dress like the gods they are actually in communication with, the Nephilim demons, and no one would realize, you know. And it was done on purpose by a Freemason called Charles Dibdin in the 1800s. He's the one who created the clown costume and incorporated it into the theaters of the day. Absolutely. And it's been adopted and molded and shaped ever since by other Freemasons who ran circuses in America. To become the white-faced, stereotypical clown that we know today with the red nose. And we'll get into it as we go on, but everything about a clown is a reference to, metaphorically and symbolically, features that are reminiscent of the Nephilim of the ancient past. Yeah.
For me, when I see things like clowns, like, mm-hmm. A lot of people have a knee-jerk reaction to clowns.
Yeah.
For me, what I think is that instinctive. Is that, and it, like, you should know that you're, like, when we see a snake, like, fuck, there's a snake. You know what I mean? Like, see a spider on a wall beside you, and you're like, I didn't mean to rhyme that, but you see a spider, and you're like, whoa, a spider.
Yeah.
Some people are like that with clowns. And it could be, because these weren't effort, they were bloodthirsty, evil, you know, demonic things. Maybe we still have that sort of sort of genetic memory, I suppose, of like that sort of like fear. Do you know what I mean? Like that built-in fear of like falling. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, coulrophobia is the fear of clowns. That's what it's called. Colorophobia, like colorophobia, which is very fitting, obviously, for a clown, a very colorful creature. And scientists today are releasing articles every now and then trying to explain the fear of clowns, you know, and why people have a fear of clowns. And it's actually one of the most common fears. It's not the most common fear. It's just up there as a very common one, you know. Like I said, spiders and snakes are really far up there. But yeah, definitely. And heights is another big one, you know. But clowns are just kind of up there in the top 10, you know what I mean? It's understood and well understood that people are just generally scared of these things. And children are, studies have been done recently, actually, which I found quite fascinating, that shows that children do not like clowns. Like, they do not like them. Like, and it's like one in like 20 children might like them. But the majority of kids are terrified of them, okay? Or just don't like them or avoid them or feel uncomfortable when they see one or ones around them. And that is very telling in its own right, because why have these things always been put in front of children as something for the kids, you know? And you look at some of these clowns from like the 1800s and the 1900s and you wonder what the hell they were thinking, because they are the most terrifying, monstrous creatures that you have ever seen in your entire life. And they're putting them in front of children, and the children are there in these black and white photos, screaming in absolute terror with tears streaming down their eyes, their muscles in their face and neck contorting and tensing up from the agony of being next to this monster. And the parents are just laughing, going, oh, isn't it cute? Isn't it funny? Like, they're just oblivious to the misery they're putting their children through, you know? And it's like, what is wrong with these people? Like, what? Yeah. Children do not like clowns. Yeah, it's constantly sold to us as something for the kids, you know? And I think there is a deep-rooted DNA-level imprint on us that makes us instinctually terrified of the image of a clown, because these things, when they were around in giant form, were eating us. You know, they were tearing us apart. They were visibly the most terrifying thing you could imagine, you know, and they didn't look like a honk honking juggling circus clown. You know, clowns are a simplified cartoon image of it. You know, the Nephilim were wide grinned, sharp toothed, snake like, wild red-haired, tall, psychedelic patterned monsters, okay, with wild feathers and hair just beaming off them all directions, huge glowing eyes, you know, radiating some kind of weird aura of power because they were half angel, you know what I mean? Then some of them may have had multiple limbs as well, and it's just, they were monsters, like, in the purest form, you know, and they were venerated as gods and kings of the time, you know, but they also brutalized their subjects, you know.
Yeah. Do you think, there's a question for you, and I don't know if I've heard this personally, but just like the thing on, like, as you say, like these Nephilim stuff, like when they were ruling the earth, like pre-Diluvian, do you think that they were, and this is just pure, we're at speculation station, this is pure speculation, but do you think they could be the pyramid builders, the pyramid building race that once inhabited the entire earth?
Yeah, they were the mound builders, the megalithic structure builders. They were the builders of the infrastructure of their kingdoms that they ruled over at the time. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's sick.
You know, people mystify why, you know, aliens must have built the pyramids with some kind of anti-gravity technology or something. Or, you know, people have speculated, oh, well, the rock must have been softer then so they can meld them all together or something, which might have been possible, you know, through technology. But it all just gets put into perspective when you realize these are just giants playing with Lego bricks. You know, it's nothing to them. And it's like, we speculate, how did human beings create such amazing large structures when these stones alone are the size, you know, the weight of like 15 double-decker buses? And it's kind of like, and it's kind of like, well, that's nothing to a giant, you know?
Yeah.
It's a bit of fun. It's a bit of fun to them, you know? And that it really answers the questions very quickly, you know? And I think people would rather speculate wild theories, because it's more fun to speculate, and maybe there's a lot of money in the speculation, but the simple answer is, and the Bible answered it quite clearly, there were giants in the earth in those days. That's it.
Yeah. 100%. Do you know what? When I talk to people, because I'm in the construction industry, right? So I'm in a lot of people's houses, and I always try to ask people, instead of like trying to tell them stuff, just to get a view of like the general sort of layman to see where their mind is nowadays. Like, and I always bring up giants, and you know, they sort of snigger and they say, yeah, giants, whatever. And I'm like, there's no point in sniggering. There's no point in ridiculing. The only reason that you don't believe giants existed is because you haven't done enough research to bring you to that conclusion. Because I've seen, personally, I've seen, like, because I subscribe to newspaper archives and stuff, and I've seen, like, the giants being dug up in these newspaper articles and stuff. So there is no question that these giants, if they existed, then, like, we have, like, stories like the Kandahar giant, like, they're still existing now in recent time. And just to sort of, like, put a bow on that one, Nick Orton, who runs the Instagram channel Tales of the Grid Square, he's been he's doing the podcast quite a bit. He was talking about an Afghan village near the Kandahar province, I swear he said that, but I could be wrong. But they had a ritual, like, yearly, that they would dye their hair orange and, like, sacrifice a goat. And, like, it might have been, like, venerating these spirits, like, trying to appease these Nephilim gods. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. You'll find any culture that does try to appease. See, there's many ways it's done in these cultures. Not all of them view it the same way. So you get ancestor spirit worship cultures. So these are the ones who dress like spirits to be possessed by spirits. And when they say ancestors, they're not talking about their grandma or granddad or great aunties and uncles, you know. They're talking about the builders of their civilization and culture, the Nephilim, you know, the ones who created their rituals and everything they have. And these are the ancient rulers and kings of the ancient past, the long dead ones, the true ancestors of their creation myth, you know. So they dress like them to evoke them, and then they usually, while possessed by them, they'll drink things and eat things to please the spirit within, you know, so it's a pleasing ritual, and usually they gain something from that, like wisdom or power of some kind. In a lot of basic tribal forms, it's also the ability not to be cut by knives or stuff like that, or the ability to walk through fire or just something like that, you know, and also advice on how to tackle a certain situation within the family as well. You'll find there's those cultures, and anybody can do that. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter who you are in these cultures. You can just join in with the tribal drum beats during the dance ritual, and you can get possessed by the spirit, you know, as long as you're dressing like it. But then there are more refined cultures who kind of create shrines to them and offer food up to them in that way, you know. And then you'll have the specific dedicated shaman who is the only one who's allowed to channel the spirit. You know, and the shaman will be psychedelically dressed up, usually high on some kind of insane psychedelic drug, and they will evoke the spirit into them, and then the community will communicate with that one individual to get answers to solve family problems and things like that, you know. So that's another way it's done. So there's the outright crazy frenzy, be possessed all over the place during a ritualistic dance version, and then there's the more refined, only one shaman gets to be possessed and everybody has to wait in line to get their answers and there be blessed by the demon within or the god within or the ancestor within, you know. So that's two versions. And then some of them just have simple oral traditions where they recount stories of these beings, you know, and maybe don't worship them necessarily, but don't deny their existence, you know. So you'll find a lot of artwork around in these cultures dedicated to depicting these particular entities. And all of them, like I said, have this clown-like feature. So like you said, this tribe in Kandahar in Afghanistan, they would orange up their hair. And probably put powder on the skin as well. It's probably another thing I imagine they do. Because in Papua New Guinea, they have the exact same ritual where they put orange straw over their head to make them look like they have wild orange hair. And they paint their skin white. And they're also venerating the same spirits that the people in Kandahar are probably trying to venerate, you know, or the people in India are trying to venerate, or Africa specifically. And even in North and South America tribes, they do the exact same thing. Some cultures are called... they're called clown societies or clown cultures. And these ones have within their rituals a specific stock character which plays the jester. And these are, like I said, the anthropologists have called these clown societies. The most famous example is the Hayoka clown kachina of the Lakotas and Dakota tribes of the North American Plains. And also the Pueblo clowns as well is another example. And two different tribes with the same god. It's a black and white striped being with crazy floppy horns. And they dress like this thing. to be possessed by it, and once they have that spirit within them of the Hyoka Kachina or the Pueblo clown, they act as irreverent clowns in that society, and they do things like walk backwards, just do things that are completely wrong, you know, and they're allowed to do that in the society, and everyone forgives them and laughs along because it's kind of like a symbol of irreverence for taking life too seriously type of thing. But you know, they have their own spirit that is specifically this clownish Nephilim like featured thing, you know, and these cultures see it as something innocent and harmless, and there is a teaching spirit of some kind. The Hyokas describe it as a thunder spirit that can bring lightning and rain. And you find that's a really common description of a lot of these beasts all over the earth. They could all ride dragons or ride on serpents and bring the rain and thunder with them. You know, the Wangina had the rainbow serpents in Australia Aboriginal cultures, and the Wangina looked just like clowns. You know, if you type in Wangina for the Australian Kimberley region, they paint these things all over rocks everywhere, and it's a white-skinned, red-haired, red-nosed demon, you know. And the backstory is they were around during a time long ago when serpents were in the sky, so fallen angels, and they worked with the serpent beings to create civilization and build all the structures. So like I said earlier, the megalithic structures that are all over the earth, you know. The Australian Aborigines know the story, and they literally represent the Nephilim looking just like clowns, you know. And as I'm saying, you know, to your answer your question about the Kandahar giant, they are definitely invoking the exact same spirits and dressing the exact same way as all these other tribes all over the earth. Yeah, it's no different.
Yeah, that's super interesting. There's one thing caught my attention when you were talking there, and it's hard to start. All of it caught my attention, obviously, but there was one bit where you said that they would be possessed to eat certain foods.
Yeah.
I saw in your video that there's a certain seed that they eat that makes their mouth go orange, ding, ding, ding.
Yeah. And
it actually slowly kills the person.
Yes. That's in the Papua Nui region of Indonesia, yeah. I can't remember the name of it now off the top of my head, but the betel leaf and the cacao nut or something like that. If I remember, they go hand in hand together. They complement each other. You know, it's like two different like chemicals that mix together to make this chewable thing that they all get highly addicted to. And it is like crack. You know, that's basically what it is. It's crack. You know, in their own version of it. And they just chew it like no tomorrow. And when they spit it out, it's like this horrible, disgusting, bright orange color. And it makes their teeth get stained in the most awful orange, grimy look, you know, and the gums are bright orange as a result of it. And it's a heavy carcinogen. So it causes cancer. It causes death. It literally kills you. You get mouth cancer and die, you know. But they're so heavily addicted to it. It's so ingrained in their culture as normal that it's just never going to go away, you know. But these things are stimulants. It's like, say, it's like cocaine, you know. So you find a lot of these tribes incorporate these herbal remedies into their rituals and their traditions and cultures when trying to commune with the spirits, you know. So the Indonesia, Polynesian regions, and then, you know, all the way up into, it bleeds a little bit into China, you know, have this particular plant that they chew. But then if you go into Australia, they have the paturi plant, and it does this again. You can chew it as a stimulant, which is like what they do in Indonesia with their betel leaves, and they use, when they chew it, it means they can go through the deserts for ages and get to the other side without getting tired, you know. But they can also brew a tea out of it, and it's extremely potent psychedelic. Then you go across to the North Americas and the American plains, and they have the ayahuasca plant, you know, which again is very popular in psychedelic circles today, and it's a mixture of a particular root and a particular leaf mashed together from two separate plants, create a tea out of it, and you can go to the spirit realm, you know. And they all kind of have their own drug to do these things, you know. In Europe, they were tripping on mushrooms, you know. they all kind of have their own cultural divine drug that gives them contact to the spirit realm, you know, whatever that is, whatever's local to the particular fauna of that area, they all seem to find it somehow miraculously. So I'm wondering if it's all kind of been orchestrated or given to them as knowledge. It did say, you know, that the people were taught pharmakia by the fallen angels and the Nephilim. They were taught how to mix herbs and roots together in order to perform these rituals and these practices to commune with spirits. You know, I do believe people were taught this stuff, because how would these tribes know to put these two completely random components together from two completely separate plants to create this one specific chemical that would perfectly create the effect necessary to get to the spirit realm? It just seems so highly unlikely, you know. It's too specific, and even the brewing process isn't simple. You know, it requires a lot of straining and re-brewing and tinctures and all sorts of things. So it just seems like they were probably told this rather than discovered it by chance. You know, that's what it seems likely. It's interesting, I didn't mention much about the northern traditions of Nephilim, but they don't follow a lot of the, this is European, they don't really follow like the other traditions, like I said, when they try and venerate the Nephilim, because it was so heavily Christianized European culture. They have a different view. They dress like demons to scare away demons. That's why we do it. We have our rituals and festivals where we dress up like the Nephilim, and we drink in excess and party, just like all these other cultures do. But we believe that we're doing it to make spirits disappear. You know? And it's weird. You know, we have a backwards view about it here. And again, I think my research has led me to believe that we have zero control over the demons. Okay. I think the demons will play along to whatever the culture thinks they're doing to control them, whatever ritual they think they're performing that will keep them trapped in a certain place. They'll pretend that that's what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever invocation ritual somebody's performing to make them think that they have to appear in a certain way, they'll appear that way if that's what the people want to see. The liars, the deceivers. I don't think it matters what, I think people think they can protect themselves from demons if they wear the right pendant, or if they perform the right rituals, or put the right amount of salt in a circle in a specific place to keep it trapped. But you don't have that control. The demon can leave the salt circle if it wants to, but it'll pretend it can't to make you believe you have some exercise of control over the situation, but you don't. You never have and never will, you know. So I think the truth is, in the West, you know, even though we believe naively we're dressing like them to scare them away, we're actually just letting them in. You know, we're really deceived. And we'll let them in and they'll try and stay hidden in our culture. Because we're heavily Christianized, we can cast them out quite easily. They have to be sneaky. They have to be careful, you know. So they do it through rituals that have been occulted. It's hidden knowledge in the West, you know. And only those who are initiated can figure out how to utilize it to their advantage if they so want to. But they need the majority of people not to believe in demons. They need the majority of the Western world to believe it's fantasy and fairy tale, you know. But in these other cultures outside of Europe, they're openly letting them in. They know what they are and they let it happen, you know, but they believe they're ancestors. So they're fine being possessed by one of their ancestors. They don't care, you know, and the culture doesn't care. It's normal, you know, but for us in the West, it's a very different situation. So if I was to go to these other cultures and say, you know, your ancestor spirits look like clowns, they'd laugh and go, yeah, we know. But to us, it's like, what are you talking about? Demons don't exist, and demons have horns and have red skin with a spiky tail, you know. Demons don't look like clowns. You're an idiot, you know. And it's kind of that we're coming from a completely different worldview, you know. We're so much vastly different from these other cultures that it's kind of, we're so ignorant, we don't even believe there's a spirit realm. Like, you know what I mean? We are so lost in our ignorant belief that we are smarter than everyone else that we don't even know the truth of the reality we actually live in, but while thinking we know everything, you know what I mean? So we are just like, we're like just open game to these demons, really. Yeah. And the sneaky characters in our secret societies who do know all this stuff, like I said, they invented their version of ancestor worship ritualistic garb. And they call it a clown. And they get us to dress like it for fun. You know? They're very sneaky. They're very clever. That's how they've introduced the demons into our society, through a symbol which we think is harmless, innocent, and funny. You know? It's very dark when you actually start thinking about it, because you realize the clown is everywhere. You know? They've put it in everything, in every form of media. They're even pushing clown fashion on us right now, at the start of this very year, down the catwalks and the runways.
Really?
Oh, yeah. If you have the internet access right now, just type in clowncore fashion runway and you'll find it's the hot new trend for 2023. And they have models walking down catwalks dressed in clown stuff. And they're encouraging other people to follow this fashion trend, you know. And what you see on the runways is outrageous. But that those aesthetics bleed down eventually into the outlets where we buy our clothes. Okay. And we'll have a more toned down version, but it's still referencing the Nephilim demons directly. You know, and that's what they're trying to get people to dress like. And we might not believe in demons, but they certainly believe in us. They still exist. And just because we don't realize what we're doing when we dress that way doesn't mean we're not susceptible to still be possessed by the thing, just like every other culture does when they dress that way. You know, it's really dark. Like, it's clearly an agenda as well. You know, it's, and people are ignorant, really ignorant to this. I mean, there's so much more about the clown history. I mean, I've just given you cultural specific examples that kind of prove culturally that everyone out there represents demons by dressing like a clown. But even the history of how the clown in the West got molded into what it is today is seeped in demonology. It seeps in it, you know. Harley Quinn, which is the original clown character, which was in the Comédie de l'Art movements of the 1600s, it was a stock character, you know, and he himself is literally based on the Wild Man of Europe, a giant, hairy, demonic beast, the Nephilim. And his original character was the Wild Man. That's who he was supposed to be. And the club he carried, which is the slapstick, was the club that the giant carried around these folk myths of Northern Europe, of the giant Wild Man, you know. All the patterns that the Harlequin would wear on his skin were supposed to represent the multicolored tufts of hair that the Wild Man had. And he was literally a demon character. He was designed to be the demonic within the play. And he is literally a copy of Nephilim creatures called Wild Men in Europe. So that's the origin of the Harlequin, first of all. And he basically, his character developed and got boring as the hundreds of years passed into the 1800s. And he kind of became less of a witty, hypersexualized, dark devil character. And he became like a bumbling, lovesick fool who was chasing after this woman. And his character became like so diluted from its source that the clown took over and became that character instead. In the same play structure, there was a stock characters and clown was one of them. But clown didn't dress like clowns today in this Comédie de l'Art movements. He just wore a plain white robe. He was a lowly servant, is what the clown character originally was. And Harlequin was the crazy clown type character, you know. But there was a switch. Harlequin's character was no longer clownish. He was more of a heroic, lovesick idiot, you know. And the clown became the devilish, over-the-top, acrobatic, crude, rude demon, basically. He became the demon character. He switched roles, and it was highly popularized by somebody called Joseph Grimaldi. He is the father of modern clowning. Clowns are called Joeys because of him. You know, that's who they name it after. He popularized the clown in British theatre, in pantomime. It was him. You know, but the clown had always been around as a character, but Harlequin was the true jester, demon, clown character up until this point in history, where suddenly, because Joseph Grimaldi was such a good actor, people loved watching him, he popularized the clown character, which then became the leading role, and Harlequin took a backstage during this weird switch that happened in the 1800s. And a Freemason called Charles Dibdin, who owned the Sadler's Wells Theatre in London, where Joseph Grimaldi worked as his, you know, he was his boss, basically. This Charles Dibdin, who was this clown's boss, did a costume change for the Harlequin. Harlequinades, they were called the pantomimes. And he invented the clown costume and gave it to Joseph Grimaldi and said, you're going to wear this from now on. And that's where we get the modern clown costume from. From this Freemason who gave it to this famous performer and said, this is how you will dress from now on, you know? So it was secret societies who injected the image of the Nephilim into popular culture through the theatre, through the movies of the age, you know, the media of the age, just like we do today, the Illuminati-controlled music industry or film industry, you know, injecting demonic symbolism into plays and films and movies. That's what this Freemason did back in the day. He was a leader of the creative arts and he injected the demonic into the most popular media of the day, the theatre. You know, it's not changed. The practice hasn't really changed since then. And that's how the clown became what it was. And from then on, as I mentioned at the start, Freemasons throughout circuses in America adopted the clown image into their shows. And it became what it was today from then. And you'll find, it's in my book, I write about this, but those particular circus performers and creators, P.T. Barnum and Bailey and the Ringling Bros, they did a combined show. They were all Freemasons, every single one of them. You know, there's like, I think there's like five brothers for the Ringling Brothers. And then there's P.T. Barnum and Bailey, two people who worked with each other, all members of lodges. And they put on a show where every single costume, every single set piece design, everything about this circus performance was created by a company who created all of the artwork and the costumes for Freemason lodges when they do their performances and their rituals.
Holy shit.
And everything was created, including all the animals and the clowns and everything, as a recreation of the rituals performed involving King Solomon in Freemason lodges. But instead of being in a tiny little lodge with just a few members of the secret society, it was performed in a grand big top stage with multiple facets and actors involved. It was the same ritual, just on a grand scale, you know. And this is all documented. They admit that that's what they were doing, you know. They were obsessed with King Solomon during this time period. It was pre-depression era in America. There was a lot of money going around, and they were trying to rebuild Solomon's temple everywhere. All the Freemasons in America were just building temples all over the place, trying to mimic Solomon's temple. You know, they kind of idolize him as a saint in their religion, because he could control the demons with his ring, you know. So they see Solomon as like one of their patron saints in a way. And the show they put on was called King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba, which is a story straight out of the Bible, you know. And it was a Solomon worship ritual. And you'll find this is where you get the ringleader from, the person in the center of a circus, you know, who wears the top hat and has his cane, and he directs the ritual, or he directs the clowns around the circus, you know, he's the one there leading the performance. Well, he is literally the grand worshipful master of a Freemason lodge. In a Freemason lodge, only they can wear a top hat. Only the leader is allowed to wear the black top hat, which you find the ringmasters of a circus wear. And, you know, just as the grand worshipful master orchestrates the ritual in the lodge, the ringmaster orchestrates the ritual in the circus, you know, directs the demons in the lodge, directs the clowns in the circus. Clowns are demons, you know, it's a representation. It's all just a symbolic creation from secret societies, literally, to venerate their gods, which are the demons. You know, so I do think the Hat Man character could be a reference to Solomon himself, the Lord of the Rings, the Ring Master, the one who used the ring to control the demons and build his temple, you know, from the story of King Solomon. Symbolically speaking, it's all there. And the clown is just a symbol that was incorporated into these rituals because they represent the demons that King Solomon controlled, you know. That's why they were there. That was the purpose of them in these rituals. But the public, who have no idea about any of this stuff, don't see that. They just see a brilliant spectacle that entertains them and the children. They don't understand the language of symbols involved in this occult ritual. They just pay to go and see something fun for a couple of hours, you know. But to the people who put on these performances, they were deadly serious Nephilim demonic invocation rituals. You know, it wasn't a joke to them. It wasn't just a performance to them. The fact that they made a shitload of money and people actually joined in on the ritual and made it more powerful is just a bonus to them. You know?
Yeah.
If
you look at like what they were trying to achieve, is you think you bring it to a larger audience.
Absolutely.
You get that, that in that intent and that energy from those that are, you know, they're expelling their energy, you know, completely low. They're cheering, they're clapping, you know, all that energy is welling up in this egregoral form of a clown. That is definitely appeasing some sort of fucking god. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, well, all these people wearing clown outfits will be channeling demons. You know, whether they know it or not, the demon's in them because they're wearing the skin of it, you know, and all that energy that's being directed towards them being glorified because people are cheering and screaming on at them because they're doing wonderful tricks. Well, the demon's looshing off that. They're feeding off that energy. They're loving, it, you know, and it's thanks to all of this that happened in the early 1900s and the 1800s onwards up into the modern day that people today dress like clowns and love it. You know what I mean? And it's that you have whole cultures and whole groups and troops of people dedicated to dressing like clowns, you know? And it's a lot of them are just naive. They just think, well, it's fun for the kids. I'm trying to entertain the children. I'm trying to do a good thing. Clowns are good people, good-hearted, kind people, you know? And a lot of them are. A lot of them probably are. They don't know what they're dressing like or what its true origins really are all about. They just don't know this stuff. So they're dressing like this, further spreading the image of the Nephilim all over through our culture. And in a way, we are a clown society just like any other. We just don't know it. You know, we have incorporated the clown into Western society as the, like a necessary archetype for us to, and when a clown appears, we laugh, we all laugh and we look at it and entertain it and we let it get away with stuff. Because it's the clown, you know. If someone comes up to a group of people dressed like a clown, you're going to let that clown do all sorts of things you won't let anyone else do. You know, you'll let them, you'll let them spray you in the face with water and trip you up or do something silly. You know what I mean? Like, and you'll just laugh instead of punching them in the face like you would for anyone else. You know what I mean? Because that's no different than the Hayoka tribes. They let the clowns do all these horrible things and they laugh about it because they are a clown society. They venerate the clown as an important figure in their society. You know what I mean? But we're just so ignorant to we're no different, but we're just ignorant to it. We're naive to the symbol. And that makes us more susceptible to it, I'm afraid. It means, you know, people are heavily demonized in this clown world we currently live in, and they don't realize it. We're opening gateways left, right, and center. I mean, I've not even talked about, let's say, the extreme far left liberal movement where the main operandi is to dye your hair some crazy color and shave half your head off, cover yourself in tattoos and dehumanizing piercings, and wear the most ridiculous multicolored clothing while sporting a multicolored flag all over your body, you know?
Who are you talking about?
You want to look like a clown any more so, then look no further than that movement, you know, and it's the same thing. They're dressing in the exact same way as the Nephilim did, you know, as these cultures who dress like the Nephilim do, but they don't realize it. And as a result, they channel the same spirits. And I think it's ironic that the mantra is pride. And I'm not talking about a sexuality thing here. I'm talking about the Nephilim being the epitome of pride. But they're the result of pride. They're the result of a prideful fallen angel not wanting to bow down to God's authority or Adam. You know, Lucifer is the god of pride, you know, and it was his angels that he convinced to go against the creator and mate with human women, the daughters of Cain, another prideful monster who killed his brother because he felt like he, you know, his sacrifice was okay, even though it wasn't, you know, and out of pride, you know, he didn't like that Abel was favored more. So he murdered him. And it's the union of these two groups of things that created the Nephilim. Then the Nephilim are literally a product of pride. And I find it ironic that those who dress in the most Nephilim-esque features have pride as their main mantra. You know, it's all symbolically there, and it's all orchestrated. Again, just like the clown was invented, so was this movement, you know. And it's not about what they say it's about. It's not about entertaining kids, and it's not about freeing oppressed classes. You know what I mean? It's about venerating and opening gateways and portals to demons. It's all it's ever been about, you know. And it's, anyway, I'm ranting. I'll stop.
You make a podcaster's life easy. Do not apologize. It's absolutely brilliant. Do you know what? I did actually hear you on a few other shows, And, you know, like other guys, like, you know, some of them are really funny. They like cut in and they just add stuff in. But I really wanted just to hear you just lay it out all out. Do you know what I mean? And it's funny you say that about the whole pride movement thing, because I've heard it equated to basically Ishtar. It echoes the story of Ishtar.
Yeah.
So Baal's wife, and the way that she would get her followers to castrate themselves and sterilize themselves. And what do you do when you have a, you know, when you do transition, you sterilize yourself essentially, you know? So it's definitely a lot of correlation there. Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. The problem is we're not allowed to talk about them that much because they're a protected class. So we'll have to kind of, I think people get the gist. Maybe we should move on from them. I call them the multicolored collective to try and get through the algorithm because that's what they are.
I call them annoying. So
we can agree on that at least. I have sympathy for these people. Don't get me wrong. I think they're being misled. They're being deceived. And so are many other people in many other factions and groups on the earth, but they themselves are probably the most direct mirror of the spirit realm corruption as I could possibly find, you know?
Here's a good way to segue off that. And other people that are being deceived is almost everyone that enjoys Marvel movie comic Venom. Wow. The correlation in that is... That blew my mind because I was like, something so sort of like not mundane, but something so sort of like in the background, you know, it's a comic book, whatever. And then I see you break it down, and I'm like, fuck, that's great. That's demon possession.
Yeah, basically, yeah. It's a stylized version of the truth. You know what I mean? There's a lot of fiction mixed in with it, but it's based on how things really work in reality. And that's what most artists, writers, filmmakers, do, is they usually, insiders who understand the truth, take the truth and then make it their own in a way so they can sell books and make films and scripts and things, you know. And to us, the uninitiated, it's like, whoa, these people are geniuses. Where do they get their inspiration from? They're just the brilliant artists, you know what I mean? The best of modern culture. And it's like, no one can think of things like they can. And it's kind of like, they didn't come up with it. They did not come up with that concept, you know what I mean? They're just the guy who drew the truth and put a different name to it, basically. But yeah, the symbiote situation in Marvel is very fascinating in the Spider-Man universe. So, you know, if people, I made a full video about it, I can break it down quickly now. I made it like a couple of months ago now, so I'd have to try and pull back my memory on this. But if I remember correctly, the symbiote is a product, a weapon created by a god of the abyss and darkness. Okay. He created these from his own flesh and blood. He's kind of like a fallen angel, satanic Lucifer character called Null. He created the black goo, which is the symbiote. In order to defeat these other gods, which are trying to invade his space, his darkness. These gods wanted to use his void to create life within it, and he didn't like that. Okay, so he basically killed a lot of these celestials, they were called, by using the power of the symbiotes, which gave him mass, like amplified his power of a god even more, you know. It was like basically primordial darkness manifested into a black goo of some kind. It was raw demonic energy manifested into a physical form, which was this immutable, ever-changing black goo that could take any form. But its form primarily, whenever it took a host, it would have a big, wide, sharp tooth, serpent, long tongue, snake-like grin, you know, with many teeth. And basically a piece of this symbiote got on Earth and possessed Spider-Man, and it takes on traits of its host. So it became a Spider-Man-esque suit of a sorts that amplified the features of whoever already wore it, you know? So it became an even stronger, more dark version of Spider-Man when Spider-Man had the suit on. The thing was susceptible to the sound of bells and sound and frequency. It was very telling in the story that Spider-Man got the symbiote off him by the sound of church bells. And during this moment, the symbiote ripped itself off of Peter Parker because of the sound of the church, the Holy Spirit, let's say, you know, or, you know, that symbolically speaking, the spiritualism of Christ got rid of the demonic possession from Peter Parker and it had to leave. But it was wandering in dry places. It needs a host to survive. So it was just like demons are said when they cast out of a man to wander in dry places, hungering and thirsting, but not being able to quench it. You know, they seek another host. They seek another home very quickly. And they'll gladly go back to the old home if you haven't filled it with the Holy Spirit and it's still empty, you know. So the symbiote leaves Peter Parker because of the sound of the church bells, and it ends up falling down the church into the pew area where someone called Eddie Brock is praying, and he's praying for revenge against Peter Parker. He's like a photographer who's been like going against him, you know, and his answers to his prayer is this demonic force appears. And so obviously you don't pray to God for revenge, but you can pray to Lucifer and the devil for revenge, you know, and he answered and he gave him the symbiote basically. And Eddie Brock then becomes this beast monster called Venom, who's supposed to be the Venom who goes against Spider-Man. You know what I mean? Like he's like his poison type of thing. And, you know, he becomes an enemy of Spider-Man from there in the initial comics. But there's even then the Venom character himself is such a joker. He's irreverent, you know what I mean? And you'll find there's another version of the symbiote, which is red. And this one latches onto a serial killer called Cletus Kasady in the series. And Cletus is already a psychopath murderer. You know what I mean? He's absolutely insane. And when he gets the symbiote on him, he becomes even worse and a monster who tears people apart. Even Venom eats brains and blood and has to cannibalize humans. You know, it's kind of how they survive. It's the adrenaline producing chemicals within the blood that it needs to feel satisfied. And it turns out chocolate gives the same effect. So Venom ends up eating chocolate rather than brains. But obviously Carnage doesn't care about that. And he ends up eating people and ripping people apart and all sorts of things. And the murderer within him is only more 10 times worse and more powerful because of it. And he accepts the demon possession. He loves the demon possession. And it's said that Carnage is the Joker of the MCU. He is the equivalent of the Joker character. It's just far more demonic than it's represented in DC. You know what I mean? And the Joker himself is definitely some kind of demonic possessed maniac. But this again, so it's just interesting that within this symbol of this weird essence that can possess people, you know, it amplifies their demonic traits more so when it possesses them. It responds to the sound of church bells in the story, specifically in sound. It hungers for flesh and cannibalism. It has serpentine, wide-grinned features and a long tongue. Its original source is a primordial fallen angel, god of darkness, who rides dragons, funnily enough. And it actually has a dragon on his chest because he is of the serpent race, just like the Nephilim are the offspring of the serpentine seraphim angels. And they are the wide-grinned, weird hybrid serpent monsters that were on Earth as a result of this angelic... It's all there. It's all just the same story. It's the biblical story, just with a different stylized... space twist, you know, like it's rather than the biblical perspective. And there's nothing unique about it, you know. And again, I break it down a lot better in the video, but that's basically it, you know.
Oh yeah, the video is fantastic. All the videos, I was meant to say it to you when we first started, but I just wanted to on the way that you make your video, because it's not like I'm not sitting there thinking, oh, you know, just come on or whatever. It is absolutely fantastic. The editing's fantastic. Everything about the videos are great, which is, you know, obviously it helps a lot when you're trying to convey, you know, like some real hard truths. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, so I just wanted to give you props on, you know, the way you conduct your videos. And so we're gonna bring this thing in for a landing now.
Okay.
Thank you very much for being here, Paul. I really enjoy your work. I'm going to continue to enjoy your work, and I cannot wait for that book to come out. I'd love to have you on again once that book comes out, and we can, you know, dissect it and go through it. Let my audience know, please, where they can find you and follow up.
Certainly, yes. I am on YouTube. That's where you'll find all my work. I'm under the name Understanding Conspiracy. If you just type in Neff them look like clowns, and you might find my videos come up eventually. You'll see Understanding Conspiracy. That's where you'll find me. I'm also on Telegram, and under the same name, I have a group chat on there, which is quite fun, which you can join in with if you want to share any of your own clown experiences with me with the demonic realm. That's the place to go. I'm trying to think where else. I have backup channels on Odyssey and BitChute, but I don't really use them, but I do back up my work on there just in case, just for posterity, just in case something ever happens where I can't do it anymore. So that's where to find me, really. Like I said, you can find many of my talks in the live tab on my channel. I have all sorts of stuff on there, collaborations. I do a weekly live show myself on Sunday where I cover all sorts of topics, but it's called The Truth of Therapy Sessions. And it's just there for us to get together and let out a bit of steam, you know, which I think we have to do every now and then in this culture. When you're in this realm of conspiracy, it can get quite isolating. So I aim to build a nice community where we can get together and kind of share our thoughts and feelings about just being one of those people who knows too much. Because, like I said, it's a lonely life. So I try to create a solid community there. And that's it. Yeah, YouTube, Telegram, some backup channels. I'm writing the book. There is a GoFundMe, which you can go and type in Nephilim Look Like Clowns book or Nephilim Look Like Clowns GoFundMe into Google, and it'll take you straight to the page. It's great. And there's a pre-order system on there. It's £100 will get you a free signed copy of the book once published. I will send it to you personally. I've already got about 20 people who I'm going to be sending those books to, which is wonderful. So in American terms, that's about $125. But I will say any amount that's donated, you get a special thank you in the book. In the end, you'll be in the book as a special thank you. So there is that as well. And that's it. And also I'm on Patreon. That's everything, I think. I forget. I'm kind of scattered all over the place, so I'm trying to remember where it all is. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Understanding Conspiracy. Yeah.
Come out, sorry.
No, just Understanding Conspiracy, YouTube. That's where it is. You'll find everything else from there. That's the way to say it.
Yeah, that's cool, man. What I'll do is I'll go through and put all the links in the description so people can just, you know, sort of click there, find you, follow up on your work and support, because that's the main thing that you can do, man, is support. And it's such a noble cause, I think, you know, trying to get this information out. And thank you very much for your time, Paul. Have a great evening, brother.
No, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye, mate.
When my roommate comes into the room looking for his car keys, I don't say it yet. And when he gets me off the couch to check underneath the couch cushions, I don't say it yet. No. And then when he says out loud, I wonder where my car keys are, I still don't say it. But then he asks me, do you know where my car keys are? I look at him in his face and I say, have you checked your binos? Get up, get up, binos. I've not seen your keys, but since you're asking me,
you better check up that binos.
Well, of course I'm not serious, I don't think it's up inside your big brown business. But a funnier thing to say to someone who's lost their shit and is stressed out visibly, when I see the best man start to sweat, I don't say it yet. When I see that little ring bearer cunt getting yelled at by his mum, oh, I still don't say it. When I see the groom asking the vicar if they can wait just another 15 minutes, I do not say it. And when the father of the bride starts organising an ad hoc emu bob of the courtyard area, I want to, but I do not say it. It's the
11th hour with 300 congregants under God's roof. The vicar approaches the mic and suddenly all of the chatter goes mute. He says that they've misplaced the rings. Could anyone possibly know where they are? I know it's my time and all heads turn as I stand and say, vicar, have you checked your buttholes? Skip that butthole. I have not seen your ring, but have you checked your ring? By ring, I mean butthole. Love is patient, love is kind. But if you ask me where you can find literally anything you've lost before, I'm gonna suggest that that is up your butthole. Where's my phone?
Is it up your butthole?
I lost my loan.
Have you checked up your butthole?
I'm losing my patience.
Check your earbuds.
Where is your class?
Think you stuck up your arse.
I just lost my grandma.
Oh my god, I'm so sorry.
Are you capable of not saying she's up my asshole?
Of course. My condolences.
I'm not looking for a silly joke right now.
Yeah, yeah. What are you looking for? Honestly, just like a shoulder to
cry. Have you checked your buttholes? Get up, get up, buttholes. Maybe you'll find your dead grandma up there too. I fucking got you, buttholes.